Section 5. Racial Issues in the Time of Reform. As you read, look for how Andrew Jackson's policy of Indian removal led to the Cherokee removal and the Trail of Tears. Plantation life as experienced by owners and slaves. Restrictions on slaves and on free people of color. And the following terms: Trail of Tears, plantation, staple crop, yeoman farmer, artisan, emancipation, slave code, quarters, free black. In the antebellum era, the rights of minority groups were restricted by the actions of the white majority in the state. Legislators passed laws that allowed them to more easily control the lives of slaves and put new restrictions on the privileges previously enjoyed by what were called free people of color. In the case of Native Americans, many had to bravely defy white efforts to evict them from their homes. The Cherokee in the Southeast. In the early 1800s, North Carolina actually included part of another nation, the area where the Cherokee lived. The Cherokee Nation was based in Georgia, and most of its 16,000 members lived in northern Georgia and Tennessee. It was considered to be one of the most civilized of the five civilized tribes, having developed its own government and even its own syllabary, a form of alphabet that allowed its people to write in their Cherokee language. In addition to the Georgia and Tennessee inhabitants, around 4,000 Cherokees still lived in North Carolina. Despite the destruction of its villages during the War of Independence, the Cherokee were still the largest Native American group in the state. North Carolina Cherokee lived in the deepest part of the mountains and kept many of the old traditions of hunting, gathering, and village life. These Cherokee also claimed to be citizens of North Carolina. In 1817 and 1819, the state had signed treaties with them, and they had given up large tracts of their land in return for reservations. Cherokee Removal and the Trail of Tears. Beginning in the 1820s, Southern whites began to harass the Cherokee and other Native American groups to give up their property so that whites could use their rich lands to grow cotton and other crops. Many whites argued that all Native Americans should be moved across the Mississippi River, away from white settlement. In the 1830s, President Andrew Jackson convinced some Cherokee to sign a treaty calling for their removal to the West. This forcible Cherokee removal began in 1838, after Jackson was out of office. Living deep in the mountains, many North Carolina Cherokee were able to hide in caves and elude the soldiers who came to round them up. These Cherokees suffered greatly. The wife and children of Yanaguska, the chief, starved to death on the Nantahala mountainside. Despite Cherokee claims that the treaties with North Carolina allowed them to stay in the state, federal soldiers continued to corral the Cherokee they could find into wooden stockades, enclosures for prisoners, on the Little Tennessee River. During 1838 and 1839, more than 15,000 members of the Cherokee Nation were forced to move to Indian Territory, later the state of Oklahoma, in a journey that was so brutal it came to be known as the Trail of Tears. In the midst of the removal, however, an incident occurred that helped some of the mountain Cherokees stay in their traditional homes. A Cherokee named Sali and his sons escaped and hid in the mountains. But while escaping, they killed a soldier and mortally wounded another. The general in charge of the removal decided that continuing to search for so many Cherokee was not working. Instead, he proposed a compromise. The soldiers would stop looking if Sali and his sons would surrender and admit to committing murder. Other Cherokee who wanted to stay in the mountains actually brought Sali to the soldiers. One tradition among the Cherokee is that Sali willingly gave himself up to allow his people to stay in their homes. Sali and all of his sons, except one who was very young, were executed by their fellow Cherokee. With the help of William H. Thomas, a white who had been adopted into the Cherokee Nation, about 1,000 Cherokee were allowed to remain in North Carolina. Because North Carolina refused to recognize the Cherokee as citizens, Thomas spent both federal and personal funds to buy land for them. Thomas continued to hold the property in his name to protect the Native Americans from whites who wanted the land. He became the chief of the settlement along the Oconaluftee River at the edge of the Smoky Mountains. The principal Cherokee community there was the Quala Village. Later in the 1800s, this became the basis for the establishment of the Eastern Cherokee Nation. Masters and slaves. North Carolina was a slave state, but compared to other places in the South, slavery did not seem as dominant. During the first half of the 19th century, in any given year, about 1 in 4 North Carolina families owned slaves. About 1/4 of the population was slave. In contrast, in Virginia, 1 in 3 families owned slaves. In South Carolina, 1 in 2. In addition, those North Carolinians who actually owned slaves most often owned only one, another indication of how hard it was for white families just to survive. Yet, at all times, slavery made a significant impact on North Carolina's economy and its society. Slaves were found in every North Carolina county, even mountain counties, where poor soil and remote location hindered any kind of economic growth, had slaves as part of their population. Some areas, however, had many more slaves than others. The greatest concentration of slaves was along the belt of counties where the tidewater met the coastal plain, from Hertford south through Pitt and Wayne counties. These counties had two factors that promoted the growth of slavery. First, the soil just above the level of swamps was some of the best in the state. Second, the good lands were located close enough to ports to make marketing costs very little. The old Albemarle Sound counties, for example, had large numbers of slaves because the dismal swamp canal allowed the cheap transportation of a variety of goods. Back of the tidal line, only a few counties had large numbers of slaves. The largest concentration was along the Roanoke River. Here, the sandy soil in places like Warren or Caswell allowed a variety of crops to be grown. In a similar way, the counties along the South Carolina line, which were close to markets like Sherrill and Camden, combined the same two factors found on the tidal line. Otherwise, slaves were scattered across the landscape, one or two in small areas where the soil was above average in its fertility. For example, only a minority of families owned slaves in Davidson County, but most families in the small neighborhood of Cotton Grove were slave owners. So were most farmers at Poplar Tent in Cabarrus County. Although most slave-owning North Carolinians owned only one or two slaves, a significant number of slaves lived on plantations, farms large enough to be strictly organized to produce both enough food for subsistence and large amounts of surplus staple crops that earned money for the owners. Staple crops were primarily tobacco and cotton, but sometimes they included grains like corn, wheat, and even rice or tar on the Cape Fear River. In each case, much more of the crop was grown than could be consumed on the farm. Less than 1 in 10 farmers in the state ever owned a plantation. Those who did, however, reaped the rewards of slavery. History by the Highway, Sir Archie. One resident in the early 1800s said that the Roanoke River was the racehorse region of America. It rivaled Virginia and Maryland in enthusiasm. Warrenton, Halifax, and Hillsborough all had well-attended races each fall and spring. During the 1820s, Sir Archie became the first thoroughbred horse in the country. Sir Archie won many races, but eventually was retired because he had little competition. He was hired out to breed other racehorses. For that, he made his owner, William Amos of Halifax, very wealthy. Sir Archie's descendant, Man o' War, is considered the greatest racer of all time. Life and labor on a plantation. Usually a white family with more than 20 slaves operated a plantation. About 1 in 100 North Carolina families owned more than 50 slaves, enough to make them among the richest people in the entire nation. Nathaniel Macon, for example, owned about 70 slaves and farmed 2,000 acres. In comparison, the average yeoman farmer, a farmer who tilled the land he or some family member owned, had about 200 acres. Although the objective of a planter was similar to that of a yeoman farmer, to feed his big family and to earn a profit from whatever was left over, a plantation differed dramatically in scale from the typical farm in several ways. First, a plantation used its slave labor to clear off and cultivate huge areas of land and graze large numbers of livestock. One Onslow County plantation was said to have cornfields a half mile long and a quarter mile wide. That one field could produce more than 1,000 bushels of hulled dried corn. Large plantations regularly produced enough corn and wheat to feed all the people on site and still send surplus amounts to market. Second, a plantation that wisely used its slaves taught some of them to be artisans. An artisan is a skilled craftsperson, such as a carpenter or blacksmith. Slave Haywood Dixon, a carpenter, was so valued by his Greene County owners that he and his family were buried in the white cemetery on the plantation. A large plantation might have a cobbler, a weaver, a cooper, or a blacksmith on the plantation itself. That way, the planter cut his costs of operation, since he did not have to pay slaves as he would his white neighbors. Third, planters often organized gang work to cultivate and harvest the fields. 22 slaves were once seen working together in a 25-acre potato patch, which meant that each was to clear an acre in a day. Slaves were sent into the fields early in the morning, and their work was regulated all through the day. This made most plantations more efficient. Even in winter months, most slaves had assigned tasks that they were to do together in groups. A plantation, or two or three plantations within sight of one another, could be a neighborhood unto itself. At Locust Hill, in Caswell County, more than a dozen planters lived within walking distance of Jacob Brown's store. Even a grist mill or schools for the family's children could be located within the range of the plantation. A few of the largest planters even kept a doctor on call for all its families, both white and black. The Pettigrew family, who had a plantation in the Pocosin south of the Albemarle Sound, kept a store where its slave could buy items with money that they earned by working harder than was expected. Prominent plantations. Plantations stood out in what was often described as a dull North Carolina landscape of log cabins and zigzag fences. Two of the most notable were built in the early 1800s. Somerset Place in Washington County in the Tidewater and Farintosh in Durham County. Somerset Place, close to the Pettigrew Farms, was carved out of a pocosin by slaves brought directly from Africa. The Collins family of Edenton, headed successively by Josiah Collins I, II, and III, prospered at the site for a half century. The first Josiah had a private canal cut into the Albemarle Sound, which linked him by water to the Dismal Swamp Canal. This allowed him to take his own barges all the way to markets in Norfolk, Virginia. The Collinses became so wealthy growing corn that they could spend part of the year in the northern states to escape the heat. Farintosh was actually a cluster of six distinct farms, each butted up against another and totaled about 20,000 acres. The farms were all owned by the Cameron family, who were descendants of some of the early merchants in nearby Hillsboro. First, Duncan Cameron, then his son Paul, ran the operations. They had their own chapel and school on the grounds. One of their slaves ran a grist mill that was kept busy with just their grain. They sent wagon trains of goods to markets like Petersburg, Virginia, each fall. The condition of African Americans. What made a person a slave in early North Carolina? In the colonial era, there was a period when Native Americans were enslaved. But after the War for Independence, almost all slaves had an African heritage. Two conditions could make a person a slave. He or she had to be at least partially African American, and his or her mother had to have been a slave. Without a visible act of emancipation, where a slave was legally freed by a master, A slave was a slave for life. The Slave Code. The Slave Code defined the social, economic, and physical place of slaves in North Carolina. Many things that white Americans took as their natural right were denied slaves. First, they lacked freedom of movement. They could not just go where they wished unless their master gave permission. When a slave was sighted on a road, a white person could ask to see the slave's pass, a written note that allowed such travel. Slaves did have some free time. They could attend church on Sunday and go to muster day or even court week, but they could do so only if the master gave permission. Second, a slave was denied most forms of advancement. A slave could learn counting, which was a skill needed on the plantation, but could not legally learn to read or write. A slave could not marry under state law, either to another slave or to a free person. The law also prohibited marriage between a white and a black person. Slaves did have their own ceremonies of marriage when they decided to live together, but the arrangements were not legally recognized. Quite often, a married slave man and woman might live on different plantations. They could only see each other after chores were done on Saturdays, and they had to be back at work on Monday morning. Sometimes slaves could earn money on their own during the hours when they were not assigned tasks by their master. One plantation in the Cape Fear was said to provide slaves 5 or 6 acres each for rice, corn, potatoes, tobacco, etc., for their own use and profit. Quite a number of slaves kept their own gardens and their own livestock. Some of the smarter masters allowed slaves to sell the produce of their own labor, which eased in some ways the poverty that went with slavery. Special feature: growing up a slave. A slave was a slave because of the status of his or her mother. Slave women gave birth to slave children. Since the vast majority of slave women in North Carolina lived on plantations and farms, most children grew up expecting to work in the fields for the rest of their lives. A notable exception was Harriet Jacobs, who later wrote a memoir about her struggle to survive and escape bondage. Jacobs recalled that her father, a skilled carpenter in Edenton, paid his mistress an annual fee from his wages and managed his own affairs. "I was born a slave," Jacobs said, "but I never knew it until 6 years of happy childhood had disappeared. I never dreamed I was a piece of merchandise." She was even taught to read. The idea that a slave was merchandise was true of any child in bondage. He or she could be bought or sold depending on the needs of the master. More than once in the state's slave records is a note that a mother, together with her increase, was to be sold like an investment. The very first known slave family in the Albemarle Sound area, Manuel and Frank, his wife, had 5 children. All were divided among the children of their owner when he died in 1709. Harriet Jacobs, orphaned at a young age, was sold to a master who abused her. After a comfortable town life during her teen years, she was sent to work in the fields at a nearby plantation. Her young children stayed behind. Most slave children did not have the same privileges enjoyed by Harriet Jacobs in her early years. Only a fraction were ever taught to read or write because state law did not allow that. State law also forbade marriage, although many black couples lived in what would have been called common law arrangements had they been white. That meant the couple had proven their devotion and duty to one another over such a long period that they were almost as good as married. But it also meant that almost all slave children were illegitimate by law. Slave children grew up in crowded conditions. On larger plantations like Somerset Place in Washington County and Stagville in Orange County, slave children were raised in the first apartments built in the state. Josiah Collins, master at Somerset, built a row of 2-storied cottages near his plantation. More than 100 slaves lived in the 10 rooms he built, meaning that as many as 10 people shared one of the 20-by-20-foot rooms. Young children on plantations like Somerset often played and helped grandparents around the slave quarters while their parents worked in the fields. At Somerset, children might hoe the family garden plots, tend the chickens, or help with carrying items in and out of the farm buildings. On almost every plantation, black children were used for minor tasks. Sarah, an Orange County slave, told her family about being a housemaid as a child. "I was kept at the big house to wait on Miss Polly, one of the master's young daughters. Sarah's dresses and aprons were starched stiff. I had a clean apron every day. It was common for slave children assigned to white children to sleep in the bedroom of the white child, most often on the floor, so that they would be at beck and call all night. Once slave children reached their teens, they were put to work pretty much as if they were adults. Most became field hands." Louisa, a slave from Richmond County, recalled later that work started at the time the chicken crowed, and we went to work just as soon as we could see how to make a lick with the hoe. "It was just work and work and work," remembered Sarah, who grew up in Buncombe County. "In any kind of weather, rain or snow, it never mattered. Boys were soon made into men as full-time workers. Young women, too, worked in the fields. Women plowed and done other work as the men did," recalled Jacob, who grew up in Warren County. "Pregnancy reduced a woman's load somewhat, but it was not unusual for a slave woman to give birth on the same day she was in the fields. She was expected to return soon after, leaving the baby in the care of older women in the quarters." Life in the slave quarters. A slave's material condition in the antebellum era varied considerably, depending upon the attitude of the master. Only a few plantations, like Farintosh or Panola in Edgecombe County, had really solid housing. Most slave homes were made of logs or poles, and the slaves had to fill in the cracks to keep out the cold air. Each family unit made do with a one-room space containing all the cooking equipment, beds, and any other furniture. In the back of the cabin, there was usually a small garden plot where slaves worked on their own time to supplement the basic food given them by the masters. Often slaves received from the master roughly the equivalent of 2 hamburger patties and a half loaf of bread a day. Slaves generally formed close bonds in the quarters, the area where their housing was located. Slaves often had their own religious services in the quarters or in a nearby barn. Sometimes they would dance and sing in ways that reminded them of their African heritage. These rituals helped slaves work together to survive the rigors of bondage. At Farintosh, the Camerons scattered their slaves around their plantations and let them be in charge of the daily work chores. Mr. Cameron made the rounds each week. If he met a slave on the road and did not recognize him, he would demand to know which quarters he lived in and why he was out and about. All slaves faced 2 horrors. They could be beaten, even for a minor infraction against a white, and they or members of their families could be sold and sent away. Slaves were often separated when the master died, and some slaves had to be sold off to pay debts on the plantations. Although only a minority of slaves were ever beaten or sold, no slave ever escaped the threat of that happening. Beatings occurred most often when a slave tried to escape, especially if it happened more than once. Those who ran away faced the possibility of being declared outlaws. That meant that they could be shot on sight by a white person. Free people of color. A few blacks in North Carolina were free, but they still suffered from prejudice and ill treatment. In towns like Fayetteville, free blacks wore a label on their sleeve that identified their condition. Most worked as day laborers for whites on farms, or quite often became tradesmen in towns. Elder Ralph Freeman, a freed slave, became one of the more notable preachers in the Uwharries during the 1820s. When the state passed laws in the 1830s to restrict how much blacks could preach, almost 100 whites came to Freeman's support to allow him to continue. The state legislature turned them down. John Chavis, born free in Halifax County, became a noted schoolteacher of wealthy young white men. He also conducted a school for free black children in Raleigh. Almost 200 free blacks owned slaves. In many cases, the slaves were relatives bought to keep them from being owned by whites. John C. Stanley, a Newbern barber, skillfully invested in land and became a planter. His family owned more than 20 slaves. In New Bern, Wilmington, and Halifax, the free black community was sizable during the early 1800s. A few free blacks in towns became prosperous, but few attained the respected status enjoyed by Thomas Day in Milton.